Thank you for tuning in to this special episode of Movie Geeks United. Tonight, we speak to writer-director John Sayles and actor Edward James Olmos about their new film titled Go For Sisters. The movie is now open in New York and will open in L.A. this weekend, and it will be available soon on instant streaming. Go to GoForSistersMovie.com for more information. Go For Sisters is the 18th feature film written and directed by John Sayles. The story concerns two women who grew up with the best of friends, Bernice and Fontaine. But as time went on, they drifted apart until their paths reconvene 20 years later when Fontaine is a recovering addict fresh out of jail and Bernice, her new parole officer. When Bernice's son goes missing on the Mexican border, the two team up to find him, and they employ the services of a disgraced ex-LAPD detective by the name of Freddie Suarez, who is played in the film by Edward James Olmos. First up tonight, we'll hear from Mr. Sayles about his inspirations in making this film, and then we'll turn to Edward James Olmos.
Your son,
he's a suspect.
In the murder?
I'll do what I can. But some of the people I gotta talk to, that's a violation of my parole.
Not if you inform your parole officer and get approval. I'm your parole officer.
Her son's gotten into some mess.
Last I heard, that boy went down to the border.
Detective Suarez, people need to talk to you.
This looks like trouble.
I want him back. And if there's any way, I don't want him to go to jail.
$2,000 up front, then. Cash.
We used to call him the Terminator.
Side business. He gets snatched by the snakeheads in TJ. They sent me his ear, man.
What's next?
We go to TJ. This is in Mexico. This is like a theme park for bad behavior. I got a good idea where to start.
You got connections with the local police?
The police don't run this town.
What is it you want to buy?
A young black man.
You're the wrong century, my friend.
Back off.
Hey, don't you push me, Morenita.
Hey, move away from her.
Ex-Detective Suarez.
They're smugglers. They have their own way of doing things. Your son might be dead already.
Was this an idea that you had in your back pocket and it was just time to get it done, or was this...
It was actually two ideas. I had kind of two movie scenarios in head. And one was about these two women who had been, you know, kind of tight friends and then, you know, kind of separated for 20 years and then reunited in the most awkward of circumstances. And then the other one was about this disgraced ex-LAPD detective. And as I started getting serious about the one, it just seems like, oh, you know, the other one could actually fit in with this. You know, once these women have to go on the road and find, you know, the son of the one of them, you know, I always wanted there to be this little switch where the woman who has the power all of a sudden loses it because she needs help from the other side of the law, where she doesn't really have much experience. And then I just felt like, well, I could combine the two of them.
You know what strikes me about all of your movies, but this one, you create such unique characters. They come from environments that feel so real, and they're all very truthful. How do you make sure that you are telling the truth with your characters?
Well, one of the things that I do that I think has been very useful is I usually do my final draft, which is mostly a practical draft, but it's a draft that I do after we've gone to the location where we're going to shoot, and we've talked to people who are involved with the world there. So in the case of Limbo, it was we talked to some, you know, salmon fishermen and had them read the script and talk to them about the, you know, the salmon fishing that was in the movie. And they said, well, you know, if this guy hasn't really, you know, captained a boat for 7 years, nobody would hire him to do a gill netter, you know, I mean a purse seiner. But a gill netter, which is a two-man operation and much more simple, somebody would trust him to do that. And so we changed, and luckily it was a cheaper way to go, but we changed the style of fishing that he did. In the case of Gopher Sisters, one of the things that I asked Lisa Gay Hamilton to do is, you know, go find yourself a parole officer who will take you through the moves, you know, and what is it, you know, and I've done a certain amount of, you know, research on this, but you're going to get much more out of it because, you know, you've got to kind of walk in this person's shoes. And she came back and said, you know, the procedure for, you know, checking on somebody's urine sample is different. You now have to actually be in the room with the client, you know, which was an even more, you know, embarrassing situation and perfect for the movie. And if there's any hint that you might have known the client in the past, you're supposed to recuse yourself, and which is also kind of upped the stakes because, you know, she's kind of breaking the rules just by calling this woman on the phone or showing up at her work when she should have said, I don't have anything to do with you anymore.
I'm so glad.
And so some of it is that kind of research, and some of it, you know, you do as the writer director, and some of it your art department does, and some of it your actors actually go out and do, and really kind of know who they're portraying.
Sure. And by the way, I just want to let you know, I'm so glad that you mentioned Limbo, because that's one of my favorite films from you.
Good,
I continuously
thanks.
Go back to Limbo. So,
and you recognize Vanessa Martinez from it?
I do, yes.
Yeah.
What a great cast.
Who's just a terrific actor who, you know, I seem to be the only person who knows about her, but she's just really a world-class actor.
Well, you do work with such exceptional actors. Gopher Sisters, certainly no exception. Do you write for particular actors, or is that a trap?
You know, I think it's usually a trap, and I think it's something unique about Gopher Sisters that it's the first time in a long, long time that I've actually had the actors in mind, at least the three leads, while I was writing. I had worked with Lisa Gay Hamilton on Honey Dripper. I'd met Edward Olmos a couple times at film festivals and always admired his work. And then Yolanda Ross had actually auditioned for Honey Dripper for the part that Lisa Gay got. So I had met her in an audition and knew, you know, her work that was, you know, on film anyway, fairly well. And just as I started writing, those three actors kind of hit in my, you know, stuck in my head. And, you know, I was lucky enough to get all three of them, you know, interested and available. With a lot of the other actors, you know, it was a bit of a search. You know, you shoot a movie as quickly as we did in, you know, 19 days, and your dates are pretty specific. So we just got lucky with, you know, actors like Isaiah Washington and Hector Elizondo and Harold Perrineau, you know, who are, you know, very well-known actors, to get them free for a day, you know, and have them come in and do something.
Edward James Olmos is a fascinating presence to me. He's such an exceptional actor, and there's no fat in his performances. There's not a wasted moment.
Yeah, he really inhabits a character, and if you think of some of the things, you know, just, you know, he had a small part in Blade Runner, but, you know, he really created, you know, a guy there that you just didn't expect, you know, stand and deliver that, you know, performance, or the guy that he played when he was Selena's dad, or some of the movies that he's done with Robert Young, where each time, you know, whether it was Gregorio Cortez or the character that he played in Caught, they're totally different guys. But as you said, there's no fat in them. You know, you don't see the work. He just kind of figures out who the guy is and inhabits them.
Is there, because this was done in a very guerrilla style, which is a style that you've grown accustomed to in the independent world over the years, is the main challenge not allowing the budgetary constrictions to limit what you're able to achieve creatively?
Yeah, I think, you know, and certainly you get better at it as you go along. So I couldn't have made this good a film with this little money when I was first starting out. You know, I just wouldn't have had the experience to plan ahead as well. But yeah, you're always trying to give the actors the illusion that there's no hurry, even if there is, you know, and you're always editing in your head as you go. So you don't, ever go for a safety take. You just say, I've got what I need to make a really good scene out of this. We're moving on. And that may mean you only do two or three takes. And with good actors, that's often all you need and want. You don't want them to have to say, well, geez, what was wrong with that one? I feel
well,
pretty good.
Trying to adhere to that schedule, does the finished film surprise you in any way, or did you feel like you had it in your head from the beginning and that's what you executed?
You know, I showed about, you know, I think I showed a rough cut of it to Kat Westergaard, who was our cinematographer, and she just shook her head and said, I can't believe we shot all of that, you know, 19 days. And so you're constantly thinking, do I actually have enough? We actually had to go back and get about four or five inserts, you know, just little shots of a hotel sign or, you know, the menu, you know, that has Sigel Camion, follow the truck, written on it and those kind of things, because we just literally didn't have time to do those things while we were shooting. And it was an extra expense. It was nice to see some of the crew people again when we came back out. But, you know, I've done movies in 4 weeks before. We did The Brother from Another Planet that way, and there were one or two little insert shots that we had to sneak up to Harlem with Ernest Dickerson, the DP, and get later on, you know. So, yeah, it's just, you know, it's the bare minimum. I think I cut one scene, you know, so the rest of editing was shaping and tightening. But you don't have a mountain of footage to carve any movie you want out of it. You know, it's pretty much, well, we'll just try to make what we've got the best it can be and give it a really good rhythm.
Hey, Freddy! I like your posse. Who is that guy, Tony Orlando?
You still got my package.
Getting back in the saddle?
Something like that.
Sister been married to police 40 years.
She had a screw loose. I ain't a cop no more.
Oh, yes, you are. You look like one.
You smell like one.
Punk guy is.
I'm curious to know, from an actor's perspective, what was the John Sayles experience like for you?
Extraordinary. I had known John for over 30 years. You know, we've been running the same circle because we both do independent films and we've done them most of our lives, and so I was very happy when I got the phone call asking if I'd help produce the movie, and I said yeah, and then after he had asked me that, and I read it, and he said, what do you think of Suarez? And I said, wow, it's a great character, it's how'd you like to play him? I said, well, Jesus, John, that's enough of that, you know, of course, it'd be my honor, my privilege, you know, playing blind people, it's not always the most difficult, but it is when you're thrown into the complexities of a John Sayles script. You know, his the way he writes is so concise and defines characters to the most, so they jump off the page. He's a true writer. And, you know, the way he created the character and the situation that he placed in was just incredible. A disgraced LAPD detective who had served for over 30 years in service and was known as the Terminator. He was so well-rounded, so well, he was so efficient in what he did. And because he didn't, he stood true to the, you know, the honor of never turning in a fellow officer and or especially your best friend, you know, he ends up turning his back on some situation that his best friend's doing and gets him busted and discharged from the police department and then, you know, disgraced to the point of where he has no pension, he has nothing, so he has literally left out the cold. And you see, when the story starts, he's losing his house and losing his eyesight. I mean, this is... And he's planting a flower in his garden, you know, when the movie starts for him.
And so what do you think he's, other than money, like a quick influx of a couple of thousand dollars, what do you think he's ultimately looking for in this journey?
Well, really, he wasn't looking for money. What he was really looking for was a sense of self-esteem, self-respect, self-worth again, which is really the whole conceptual understanding of humanity, of our lives. Self-esteem, self-love, self-respect. That's all we can ask for. And everything else is true happiness is being content with oneself. Understanding yourself to the point of where you look at yourself in the mirror. So he couldn't do that anymore. He not only couldn't do it psychologically, he couldn't do it physically. He had gone blind. He could never see direct anymore. By the time the movie starts with him, if you put your fist less than a half an inch away from your eye, and you look straight into those fists, that's all he could see. Now, if you put your hands up there, you'll see that you have peripheral vision. You're looking right into your hands, but outside of the hands you can see, but that's all you can see. And so if you look, you really can't see anything. You can see to the side. If you turn your head a little bit, you can see to the ground. You could see, you can see your foot if you move it. If you move your foot, you'll see it. If you keep it still, it'll kind of blend into you can't really tell that it's there. You can see something, but you don't know what it is. So if you really get into understanding what, macular degeneration is, it's devastating. It's a slow process of going blind. From a person that can see to a person that loses complete eyesight. If it goes to the extreme, it's you're totally blind. You'll never see again. So, and you're losing it slowly. It hemorrhages. It's really tough. It's a tough disease. And when he gave it to me, and I said, "Oh, Jesus, John, thank you very much." He had no idea where I was going to take it. Because he could be in first stages of macular degeneration. That's like a pin, like the size of, let's say, of a 5-cent piece, about five inches away from your face, your eyes. That's what's covered, and everything around that, that little 5-cent piece, you can see. And if your both eyes are in the same position, if both have 5-cent pieces, you can see all around it. You can see people. You've got a lot better vision, but you don't have any vision in that little 5-cent piece. So that's how it usually starts.
Hearing you talk about the depths of this character, it gets me to thinking that the job of a great writer is a lot like the job of a great actor. It's about finding the lines between the lines, the life between the lines, I think. And when you're creating this character, how much did it all fully come from the text, or did you go out and try to find a model for the character? How did that work for you?
It came from the text. His writing. Remember one thing. You saw the movie, so you know what the experience was. I did not add one word, nor did I take away one word. I did not ad-lib one moment. So then you realize how well written this is, to the point of where you're sitting there and, I got to take a nap. It's so well thought through.
Yeah.
Just think about what the guy did. Just amazing. And then, the fact that he did, he wrote the African-American women. Come on, Jesus, how long is that hard to do? Trying to find the voice of an African-American woman.
Yeah, he really is extraordinary. And he's the voice of... he is a major figurehead in the world of independent film, rightfully so. And I love independent film primarily because it explores the human experience. And that's something we get less and less of in mainstream cinema. I would imagine that draws you to independent film as well as an actor.
Yeah, sure. I have done independent film from almost the get-go. The very first movie I made was Aloha, Bobby Rose, where I got my SAG card, and I played an extra. and then I was she catapulted up to a higher status during the shooting. So, you know, we have, from the very offset, we've had a tremendous, you know, journey in the independent world.
Just one more question for you. I was talking to Mr. Sales last week, and we were talking about you. And I said what amazes me most about your great performances is that there's no fat on your performances. There's nothing wasted. There's no flourishes that don't belong. Did you've been doing this for so long? As you've gotten more and more experience in the field of acting, have you kind of simplified your technique?
Yeah, I think you do. I think you become much more decisive. The strokes become more exact. So you're more confident, you know, and so the decisions you make are come with a lot of wisdom because of age. So it's all of the above. I mean, yeah, you do. It's a lot more fun because you don't have the opportunities that you do when you're a kid. This is a youthful kind of art form.
That's it for this episode of Movie Geeks United. For more information on the film Gopher Sisters, visit gophersistersmovie.com. And for complete access to our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews, visit our website at moviegeeksunited.net.